Joe Parr. It's time for Blind Like Me again, and let me get my... There, my stopwatch is going. And it is Rick and not Rich. I think I had Rich written down. Rick McCracken, how are you, sir?
Yeah, we're still poor, but it's Rick, yeah.
We're still poor, but it's Rick.
Fine, how are you?
Your friend John Conley said Rich, so we can blame him.
Oh, yeah, anything you can pin on John is all right with me.
I was going to say for that and many other things. John John has more money than he needs. He just buys things. He has more equipment than most radio stations.
He's one of the most effective wasters of money that I've ever known. And, yeah, I wouldn't mind working in John's house because he's got some better gear than we have around the radio station I work for.
I never thought of that. One of the most effective money wasters you've ever known. That's good. I'll use that. Steal that from you. Anyway, you're a radio man. You work at, what's the call letters of the station where you are?
WSOC-FM in Charlotte, North Carolina, since we're east of the Mississippi. We're debuts out here.
And you've been there for, I think you said,
22 years.
22 years.
Yes, sir.
Well, we want to talk about that, yes, but let's get back into some earlier days of you. What is your level of vision now?
I guess, if you understand the numbers, I guess my one eye is corrected to about 2,400 with glasses, and the other eye is total.
The other eye is total. So you really have very little usable vision.
Yeah, not a whole bunch.
Can you still distinguish faces, one person from another, or not?
If I'm close enough, I can see faces, but not detail. I mean, with me, it's all about the big picture. I see the big picture pretty well in most instances, but the detailed features of anything aren't really there.
But it has. At one time, you had better vision. At one time, your vision was much better.
Probably always been about the way it is. Maybe it was a little better back when I was in school. Mm-hmm. But, you know, once you start to get older, you use it all up.
Lose a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I guess you said you went to school with John Conley, so you're in your early 50s.
Thanks for pointing that out.
I knew you'd appreciate it. I knew you would.
I'm just north of the high 40.
Yeah. North of the high 40. Well, I turned 68 yesterday, so I don't feel bad for anybody.
Happy birthday.
It was just nothing to it. Once you get that old, it just passed right by, thank God.
I start getting greedy, actually. I want to collect as many as I can get.
Let's see. And so you were born back in the early 50s, sometime in the 50s. Uh-huh. You were born with this eye condition. They know what caused it. Why are you...
Part of it was congenital cataracts. My mother was never told that she was blind, but she was.
Uh-huh.
Luckily, her eyes were strong enough that with some corrective lenses and cataract surgery, she was able to live a pretty normal sighted life. But she had congenital cataracts, and I had congenital cataracts, and then glaucoma in one eye early on in infancy, I do believe, and it's just, you know, things never got any better. So,
but you say your mother didn't admit this. She didn't acknowledge
the fact.
Well,
she didn't know it. I mean, mother was, she was one of eight kids that grew up on a farm, and, you know, my grandparents, part of the reason you got to, you know, you have to remember these are people that were starting a family in the Great Depression era.
Uh-huh.
And part of the reason they had so many kids was so they'd have plenty of help on the farm.
Well, yeah.
She was the only one who couldn't seem to get things right. You know, she couldn't drive the tractor like all the other girls could. She couldn't, she had just a whole lot of trouble functioning. And, of course, they all said she was lazy.
Yeah.
And she just didn't want to do stuff. And it turns out that wasn't it at all. She just couldn't see what she was doing. So about the time they diagnosed me, they also took a look at her and said, oh, yeah, by the way, you've got cataracts too, and that's probably a big part of your problem. So,
yeah. Bless her heart.
She had it pretty bad and didn't have anybody to understand her. I mean, even her own parents didn't investigate what the situation was. So, she's my hero, and
really?
if it weren't for all that she had gone through, you know, then I probably wouldn't have had it as good as I did growing up. She got me into a doctor and a specialist, and you know, right away he started working very diligently, and you know, it was he who got me into blind school, I do believe. So if it hadn't been for her strife, you know, I don't know what I'd be doing today.
What you're born in? You're a Texan by birth?
Yes, Texan by well, Texan forever.
Yeah, born where? Where in our great Lone Star State?
A little town in north central Texas called Dublin. Dublin is still the home of the best Dr. Pepper bottling company in the world.
Well, you're a Texan.
Yes, indeed. Grew up up the road in Stephenville.
In Stephenville. I know about where that is. That's just south of the Fort Worth, Dallas.
Southwest of Fort Worth, about an hour. Mm-hmm.
Major complex. And sure enough, in Stephenville, there's a little radio station, isn't there?
Yeah.
KSTV, I think it is.
Yeah, that's one of them. There are two or three there now, but when I was growing up, there was just the little AM KSTV, it was not a monument to great American radio, but it was all we had, you know, unless you tuned to the stations in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Oklahoma City, and sometimes you could get WLS in Chicago, and you could even get LAC and WSM in Nashville, and that's probably where I got into the radio thing from, really. That was my...
Well, you say it wasn't much of a radio station, but it served a certain need. It read the funeral announcements, I'm sure, and maybe the hall markets.
Oh, yeah, the hospital report and the swap shop and all that good stuff. Stuff that I would later go on to do myself.
I'm not sure that type of radio wasn't superior to some things we have now, whether we have disc jockeys in Chicago reading the weather for Lufkin, Texas, you know.
Well, you are exactly right. I mean, there have been many a day around here when I've said, man, I miss the stuff I used to do back in the small markets. You know, it's cool to be up here, but gosh, I wish I weren't limited, because there are some things that I used to disdain back in the small markets that I sure would like to be doing now. So, hindsight's 2020, I guess. But
those old boys that put those radio stations on, a lot of them after the war, they started allowing those little daytimers put those radio stations on, eventually became millionaires off those little...
Oh, yeah.
Those little radio.
Yeah.
They would,
I know a few people who have cashed in big time on those little stations.
Yeah, we had three or four here in Lufkin here in East Texas of old boys that put on a radio station. Really didn't know that much about radio, but they knew business. Old boy over at Crockett, and he sold that thing for $1.3 million. It's amazing. Crockett, Texas, $1,300,000 for a radio station. Crockett, Texas. That's that's pretty amazing, folks. Yeah. Anyway, take your money. That's what he did. Well, he took his money, and about 6 months later, he died. Bless his old heart, old Jim Gibbs. He's a good old man. They say one old boy said, when I applied for a job here, I found out just how frugal Jim was.
Yeah,
those old boys didn't pay me. Anyway, so when you were old enough to go to school, they sent you to the Texas School for the Blind. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
And how did you find that in your early years? It was about, I guess, about 60, 61, somewhere around there?
63. I was born in 57. I went at the age of 6. They didn't have kindergarten yet. So I started first grade in 63, and I have pretty vivid memories of just about the entire childhood. I remember, you know, it was just a completely different world.
Boy.
At that time, it was extremely regimented. I mean, you know, we... you lived by an extremely well-maintained schedule. We had, at that point, the Supreme Court hadn't said anything about what you couldn't say in schools yet. So we had chapel two or three mornings a week.
Yep.
On campus. We had generally in the dorm before we went to bed at night, there were some song services or, you know, little devotionals that we had. It was very structured, and it was very it was a place of great discipline. But of course, the winds of change we're about to be blowing, though. So
the winds of change are about to be blowing. But you were there in Cottage K, I believe.
Oh my gosh!
right?
Yeah, Cottage Cave. That's where everybody started out. They had a boys' side and a girls' side and a little courtyard in the middle, and then down below were the classrooms. So,
and you slept in that long dormitory room there with about 30 other kids?
Yeah, that's right. We all had little numbers, and it was the height of institutionalism. It really was.
Was it? Was W.E. Allen still there when you came?
Actually, he was, yes. Mr. Allen was still the superintendent for my first couple of years, I guess.
And F.G. Tackard?
Yes, he was still there, too. And, I think he left after my first or second grade year.
How about F.E. Lewis?
Oh, why, buddy?
F.E. Lewis, I guess.
Why, buddy, was there? Oh, yeah, well up into my high school years.
Still there, and Bob Young, I suppose, was there. And
Bob Young was there up until I think I was a senior or so.
Yeah.
In high school here. You may have been there all the way through.
Well, I left in 58. So I left just before you got there. We didn't cross paths. I left them in 58. They asked me not to come back in 1958. I knew what I wanted to do, and that was be a disc jockey, and nothing was going to stop me. No piano tuning or chair caning or nothing was going to deter me from what I wanted to do. So you did your 12 years there at the School for the Blind.
Did my 12.
But things got a lot better at that school during the time you were there.
Things, of course, we're going to progress in America or going to change, whether it's progression or not.
I mean,
in the mid-60s, of course, the school's integrated. And, you know, I'm really happy that, like, we didn't have any trouble back in those days. Nobody cared. You know, it was all just fine with us. More people to meet.
You didn't care.
We found that we started having a few more freedoms as time went on, and by the time you're in high school, you're able to go off campus by yourself and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it was still a pretty regimented institution all the way through. They did start looking a little more outward. I know that I played in a number of bands, and not only did we get to do tours of different schools and so forth in Texas, but occasionally we would actually get to go to some of the Austin television stations and be on a local program down there. And so they started looking outward a bit more later in my tenure.
I remember I went back in sometime in the 60s, maybe 65 or so, and they had built a cafeteria or a lunch counter or a snack bar in the basement of the main building there.
Which, had it there for a long time, and had a canteen, they called it.
Oh, it was was heaven.
Oh, yeah, that was the focal point. I mean, everybody went down there to meet after school because that was really, unless you were in organized sports, that was about the only thing there was to do.
Yeah. That was it. I mean, if you wanted to see your girlfriend, I guess you could see her there at the canteen.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then eventually, of course, we were able to actually go and hang out at the girls' dorm. Not inside, but on the front porch.
Well, they built that building between K and the main building that had at one time had a swimming pool in it.
And it was, yes, indeed. It was the pool. And I was back there a couple of years ago for the sesquicentennial of the school. And that pool building is still there. Now, much of that campus is about to be completely demolished and rebuilt. In fact, they already have quite a few new facilities on the campus. But all the core dorms, all the core buildings are going to be completely raised and replaced. In fact, I think when I was there, they'd already stopped using one of the dorms.
Well, they had gotten, I think, some $70 million grant or something to rebuild that campus. Of course, it had been a long time. If you remember correctly, those old dormitories were retrofitted with electricity. There was conduit running along the wall. So
they were retrofitted with everything. Yeah, while I was there, when I first started at TSB, we didn't even have air conditioning.
Yeah, we didn't either.
They started dropping that in the mid to late 60s. And then in the early to mid 70s, they came through and they put all this coating, they put all this new facade on the outsides of the buildings, and and redid the insides. You know, they just basically patched over everything that was there. And, you know, that held up for a while, but those buildings were built in the mid-teens, so they pretty much served their purpose. And,
well, when I was there, they came in and they did these what they call sight-saving lights that were huge lights that just when they came on, you could hear them. You could hear them.
The old fluorescent tubes.
Big, huge lights that just heated up the room tremendously. So those, so the sighted kids could read. Up until then, if you were at the blind school, you read Braille. I mean, that's what you did.
Yeah.
This probably happened in the mid-50s or early-50s. Up until then, if you, no matter what you could, what your eye of vision, like my friend Don Patterson sees almost well enough to drive the car. And he was reading, he was, thank God for this, he was reading Braille. Of course, he was able to parlay that into a job with the school district here as a Braille transcriber. But they had him reading Braille just the same as he did me, and I'm totally blind.
Odd, though, how what we used to call sight-saving lights are now just plain old fluorescent tubes in every office in America.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We called them sight-saving lights. Okay, so you did 12 years at the School for the Blind, and you got interested in the things that blind people love the most, and that is music and radio.
Yeah, sound. You know, pleasant sound is what I've always been interested in. Music was easy, and I hate to say music was easy because, you know, the stereotype, Phil, people think, well, he's blind, he's got to be a good musician.
Yeah.
Well, doggone it, I'm sorry, but it was easy. You know, guys that I grew up with would sometimes, you know, just sit around on their bed chairs or in their rooms for hours listening to the radio, listening to the different jocks on the radio. I mean, keep in mind, this was the 60s and early 70s, and it was a great time for not only American music, but it was a great time for American radio. In the beginning, you had the top 40 stuff was rocking strong, and then by the time I got to be a teenager, you know, the FMs were starting to come on with this album oriented rock, and so you had an outlet for Jimi Hendrix music and Van Morrison and all that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was a great time to have very active ears. And I just learned, early on, you know, how to, I did learn how to read Braille music, but you can't read music and play at the same time, so I learned very quickly how to.
No, you can't.
No.
That's pretty hard to do.
I learned how to play by ear.
Yeah.
And all that, and, you know, and TSB had a phenomenal music department. I would never have known that when I was there, but having raised children up through the public school systems in my lifetime, I realized that. Gosh, we had it pretty good as far as music education.
There was a piano every 30 feet.
Practical. Oh yeah, all the practice rooms had pianos.
Yeah, there was just, I mean, there were probably, I'll bet there were 150 pianos on that campus. That's not exaggerating.
There were a bunch. I tried to tune as many as possible, but
I did too.
Fear back in the day.
I did too. Who was the tuning? Was McKinley was gone by the time you got there, right?
Yeah, I had a wonderful guy named George Lane, and God rest his soul. He died of a stroke 25 days before I graduated high school.
Is that right?
Really, great sense of humor, and a pretty good piano tuning teacher.
You didn't have Tommy Griffith in you at all?
No.
I'll be darned. I thought he'd had that tuning department down in the basement of the main building of the School for the Blind. A big
That's where we started. Then when they started doing a lot of expansion, we moved over to the new industrial arts building. Yeah.
Yeah, and we go over to those practice room pianos, you know, and. That was the deal every day. I always try to, you know, after dinner, go get a practice room piano tune so I could have a little nap. smoke me a cigarette and go have a little nap in a practice room somewhere. Nobody really cared. So 12 years at the blind school, you got interested in radio. And like you said, blind people sat around and listened to the radio. I mean, that's what we did.
It was our window to the world. It was, you know, it brought us all the stuff that we couldn't really see or couldn't see clearly.
Yeah.
The other thing that I really liked that came on, obviously, in my childhood was television. I was fascinated with the way it worked.
Really?
At one point, I knew every lineup for all the three networks. I knew exactly what show was going to be on what night. I got very interested in how it all worked and started reading books about it. And naively, I thought that I could probably be a director, a technical director. You know, didn't realize how important the eye was in setting up shots.
Yeah.
So
That'd be pretty hard to do.
That's what I wanted to do. TV was going to be it, man.
It'd be pretty hard to do for a blind person to be a director.
I found that out in college.
I guess. Yeah, and so you got interested in what instruments do you play? What is your primary?
Got through school on the clarinet, dabbled around with the saxophone a little bit. Had a little fun with that. Clarinet was my major instrument. Got through college on a scholarship with that instrument, and of course, like most kids, learned to play a little bit of guitar and thought I could sing and we did sing in chorus and stuff back in school.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you just did everything you could. If somebody in the dorm wanted to put a band together, hey, I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, we had two or three different combos, and generally I played in all of them. It was fun.
I've always said if you were standing on the front porch smoking a cigarette at Cottage D, if there were six blind people there, you had a quartet.
Yeah.
Because at least four of us could get any part you wanted gotten. It didn't make any difference
what it was.
It'd get any part there was.
It was just the music was organic. It just kind of sprang up. It grew out of nowhere, and it was just tons of fun back there. I wish we had some of the technology back then that we have now,
so we could
document it all a little better.
Yeah, you know? Of course we didn't. The 30-minute tape was about all you had. Nobody had tape recorders.
That's right.
But that just was one quick side note. That cacophony of noise that you used to hear from the main building, where you'd hear some guy practicing trumpet and maybe a guy practicing sax and pianos coming out and a girl singing opera upstairs, that loud cacophony of musical noise that came from the main building in the afternoon is no more. It's gone.
Yeah,
that music department is no more. It's not there anymore. And that's sad to me. Because we all, you know, everybody played something. I mean, everybody, there were piano players by the, you know, if there were six blind people together, there were two or three piano players. We all played piano, a little bit.
Yeah, and think of it like this, too, Phil. You know, we weren't exposed to a lot of art. And certainly we weren't exposed to any visual art growing up. I don't think I ever took any lesson at all in school about Van Gogh or
Rembrandt
or Picasso or anybody, but we were all exposed to a great deal of classical music art, and that was the best exposure that we got. It was extremely important to all of us.
And then the radio exposed us to country and rock.
country and rock and great Motown and Philadelphia sound and R&B, and then, oh, man, just a wealth of music in this country.
So at 18, you thought you could do maybe something with television, and you went to college. Where did you go to college?
Went to college up at, then it was called East Texas State. It is now part of the A&M system.
Yeah, it was at Commerce.
I'm trying to disavow that. Yeah, it was in Commerce.
Yeah,
I had a scholarship up there. I went up there in the first year. I majored in music.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of that year, I still loved to play, but I determined I cannot see me spending my life writing marching band charts. East Texas was a very strong music education school. You know, that's about all they taught dealing with music was music ed. So I really wanted at that point to go into maybe the record biz, thinking, okay, I could take my musical knowledge and parlay it into producing records or something. Well, they didn't have anything like that on campus, and I couldn't afford to lose my scholarship. So I went to the next best thing, which was radio TV. And, hey, there's TV. I'll get to find out what that's all about.
They had that at East Texas State Teachers College?
By then it was East Texas State University.
Uh-huh.
And, they did have a radio TV department. It was radio TV area. It was in their speech and drama department.
Uh-huh.
And so I was able to keep many of my musical studies going and keep playing, but I changed my major to radio TV and started the coursework and started the lab work there, and eventually I got on in an unpaid position at the radio station on campus, and then later a paid position at the radio station. And the TV thing, I learned very quickly that I didn't like it because it was too much hurry up and wait around for other people, and if you didn't all have the same vision, nothing got done. And it was just a lot of sitting around, you know, wasting time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the whole, well, yeah, I really can't line up a shot the way I probably should.
Well, there would be that.
Yeah.
You'd have to have some good vision. So television went out, and then you go. But you never did as a kid. You didn't want to be a disc jockey.
Oh, it was another one of those things that was like so. It seemed so easy, you know, that I just kind of took it for granted. I mean, my grandparents would laugh at me, you know, when I was four or five, sitting around the house imitating KSTV,
yeah.
You know, before I ever even went to school. So mimicking was always easy. But yeah I wanted to I really wanted to kind of bypass radio and go on TV. And then once I got into college, I discovered that radio, even though it was a public station, a college station, was still a whole lot more fun.
And a whole lot more accessible for you as a blind person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, I've never looked back. I've done a little on-camera TV work here in Charlotte, hosting or helping to be involved in, you know, fundraisers for the local public television station or something, but I've never looked back and wished that I could have, you know, could have been this or that in the world of TV. Radio has just been a lot of fun and you know, rewarding enough.
And so they gave you a paid position at this this on campus radio station at the college there in Commerce.
Yes.
Doing what?
I was actually hard to believe in this economic time, but back then they actually paid their music director. So that was pretty cool.
Really?
I was the music director, and I hosted a couple of shows, and I produced I recorded recitals in the music hall, and I chopped those up and made long form live concert programs out of them. And so I was the music director, and we had all variety of formats, because obviously you do a lot of classical.
Sure.
when you're at a public station. But we did our morning show was kind of an adult contemporary format, and then at night guys came in and did something that was completely freeform. It was generally rock, and then Saturday nights we usually had jazz, and I often came in and hosted the jazz show on Saturday nights. So there was a lot to keep up with musically there.
You said you chopped up those concerts. You could mean that literally, and did you mean that literally?
Yeah, the hardest thing I ever had to do in the world of broadcasting, and the most, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say the hardest, but one of the most frustrating challenges I ever had was I once had to splice a cassette. Splicing reels is bad enough.
Oh, it's horrible.
You have to splice a cassette, and it was recorded not by me, but it was recorded by someone in the music department only on cassette, and it was a visiting professor's recital. So there was no way to get him back or anything like that. There was absolutely no way that if this cassette was broken and I threw it away that I was ever going to be able to recover this recording. So I spliced it and dubbed it, and immediately it broke again. But it didn't matter because
you already had
a copy. I had performed one successful splice.
Now you took the screws out of the top of the cassette and spliced it as if it were a reel.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, on reel-to-reel machines, often you would have what's called a splicing block.
Yeah.
A little block with a groove that you could lie the tape in. So now the cassette tape was not as wide as the regular tape.
No, it's half as wide.
So you had to be very, very careful, but I laid it down like toward the bottom of that groove. And just putting the tape on it was so difficult because that stuff is also very, very thin. You know, it's less than a half a millimeter thick. So, that taught me a lot about patience. And ruined a really good Saturday.
I had a thing that had a clamp on each side. You've probably seen these. Had a little clamp on each side that you could lay the tape and clamp it, and then you push this thing up and it would cut it, and then you pulled it down and it would actually put the... It was a little splicer.
You had the little guillotine.
Yeah. I had a couple of those at different times. I just pried, maybe 2 years ago, I pried my splice block up off the console in my studio. I pried it up and put it away. I didn't throw it away, but I put it away, along with my bulk tape eraser. And, you know, because I was a real guy. I was, and I electronically edited mostly, but I learned to splice tape also. So this college, you were the music director. Did you stay there after you got out, after you graduated, or?
No, I kind of looked around for some jobs in public radio stations, but every college just wanted to use their own graduate students. And
yeah.
At mine, you know, I wasn't willing to go to graduate school immediately after I finished. I probably should have, looking back, but so I found a job, and the first place that would take me, it was like pretty much the end of the world. But when I was done with college, I got on out into the world and got myself a real job.
At where?
The first commercial job for me was at a radio station in Seymour, Texas, which
KSEY would be the call letter.
Yeah, that was it. You're just you're uncanny knowledgeable.
I know Texas radio, but I may not know anything else, but I do that.
Yeah, the place is about 50 miles west of Wichita Falls, and
yeah, it is.
I worked through the hottest summer and the coldest winter I think I've ever spent, all in one year.
A little daytimer in Seymour.
Mm-hmm. That was it.
Well,
it had a pre-sunrise authority, so it could come on early and it could stay on until about midnight. I was news director, and I did, pretty much every shift. I don't think I did morning drives except for maybe once, but I worked there for a year and honed my disc jockey skills and ate a lot of crow, because I had said that back in college that, I'll never work in a country station, never. And then first gig I get out of school is a country station. And I was just being a snob, because I'd grown up listening to everything, including country. My grandpa, my papa, and I used to sit around listening to WSM on Opry nights.
Listen to Ernie Stubb, Hank Snow, and all those old guys.
Oh, and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And all those 30-minute syndicated shows that used to be on Channel 11 on Saturday nights.
Oh, yeah.
Out of Fort Worth. The Panther Hall Ballroom, and then you had the Wilbur Brothers show. And the
Porter
Black
Wagner
show
and
Porter,
yeah.
And Ed, they were all there. I mean, so I knew all that stuff. So it, really going to country music wasn't difficult. And as it turns out, because I've done a few other formats along the way, but as it turns out, country was what allowed me to be myself. And I was the most comfortable with that particular format. So I guess that's why I've been in it for about 30 years now.
Seymour, Texas. Well, it's amazing, because I have an old engineer friend who started out at that. That's the reason I knew the call letters there. It started out at Seymour back in the 50s years ago when it first came on. So I know two people who worked at Seymour. It's amazing. Anyway, so you were always sending out air checks from Seymour, always trying to get WBAP to hire you or somebody to.
I didn't really send out too many. And in fact, you know, the first year I was just trying to get my my feet on the ground. I remember that I had been at the TSB for 12 years and then straight to college. And with the exception of one summer, I went straight through college. So I had always been in some kind of institutional setting and had never spent any time really dealing with the world as it truly was. So I spent that year in Seymour just learning how to live, you know, learning how to pay a bill and run my own house and just find out what society expects of you.
You were single at this time? You were single?
I was single.
So you had to rent an apartment and learn to cook a little bit?
Rented a trailer. The trailer was right by the radio station, and Phil, because you know radio, you know that AM radio stations have a ground system.
Oh, yeah.
And if the ground system functions badly, then you have RF, radio frequency, that just kind of spills all over the place. And my trailer was close enough to the radio station that I couldn't even use my phone without getting RF burns. So during that first year in radio, I got a lot of burns.
But you were close. If you had RF in the phone, you were close to the radio station.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was in the next lot. So all I did is walk out my back door, take a few steps, and there it was.
So you could walk to work every day. You were there. Absolutely. If the radio station had a problem, you were there to solve it.
I was, unfortunately, I was the guy that was too close. You know, the guy that lives the closest is the guy you call whenever there's a problem.
Oh, I would have loved that. I wouldn't now, but there was a time when that would have been, you know.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I ate it up. I was the big star. I wasn't, but, you know, I was there all the time. So.
But radio seemed much more important back then than it does now, for some reason.
It was, yes. It was awfully important back then. It was still completely local. There was very little syndication back then. Yeah. News was still a commitment. The FCC had a standard called PICON, the Public Interest, Convenience, or Necessity, and every radio station, when they applied for a license, had to prove that they could satisfy that rule. And so that was the reason that we did news not only to inform the listener, but because we were committed to spend so many minutes a week doing news. So
yeah,
we did
news,
we did public affairs, all that kind of stuff. Everybody back then was full service. With format fragmentation came the demise of you know, full service radio, and of course now with consolidation, and this is a whole other topic, whole other show really.
Oh,
consolidation, we pretty much killed it off.
Yeah, it has. Consolidation is pretty much killed, but then radio was doomed anyway. I don't know what's going to happen to terrestrial radio. All right, where'd you go from there, from your little job at Seymour?
I worked in Seymour for a year, and then I went down to Breckenridge, and I thought, wow, this is a step up. Actually, it really wasn't, but I went down to Breckenridge and worked for a station named KSTB, which, you know, I grew up in Stephenville with KSTV, so a little different. But this station in Breckenridge was a little closer to my hometown, and considering that there wasn't a lot of transportation options, it was a little easier. It was a little better for me being, you know, 90 miles from Stephenville as opposed to 180.
Yeah.
That way, if mom or my sister or something, you know, needed to come up or wanted to come up and take me somewhere, they could do it. And it was down in Breckenridge where I got to do a whole lot more, where I ultimately, you know, met my wife. That turned out to be a good move.
And this is the wife you still have?
Only one, yeah. Okay.
Only one, your first wife.
Shaker.
That's good. That's good to know. So you worked there, but you did about the same thing there you did in Stephenville. Same kind of radio station, right?
Or in Seymour. Yeah, pretty
Seymour,
much. It was an AM daytimer, and I did every single thing there. I even at one point handled the morning show for a long time.
Yeah.
And then while I was there, we came online with an FM as well. Or actually, it was a competing company that came online with an FM. They would eventually merge, and I would eventually work at both. So I had a lot to do, and one thing that I got to do there was do color for high school football. Breckenridge had a rich history of high school football.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would go out each week, and I would talk to the stars of the game, or those who were expected to be the stars of the game, and I would also talk with the coaches. And then during the game, whenever other guys were describing the action, I would say, well, yeah, Coach Brown said that they were going to be doing, you know, they were going to be dropping back their coverage in these situations. And so I sounded like I knew what I was talking about. And then, of course, I would do the pregame and postgame interviews and all that good formatic stuff.
Could you see the game?
No, I could see this massive, you know, scrambled eggs moving around the field, but I could never tell where the ball was. So I would just depend on those guys to tell me the story, and then, you know, I'd comment on it.
So you would, they would say, well, he picked it up on the 12, took it out to the 18, now it's gain of 6. Yes, they told me they were going to. And so, that's amazing. I'd like to have some tapes of that. Blind guy doing color.
You know, there are some others that do. Yeah. I can't remember the guy's name, but down in Charleston, South Carolina, there is a color commentator for a minor league baseball team. And I really don't know how he does it, but
I don't either.
He's been doing it for a long time.
I don't know how he could possibly. You know, how would he know?
Well, if you're with a good setup guy, you know, if you're with a man, if you know the sport and you're with somebody who can describe the action, then you could figure it out. And let's face it, all these things are rich in statistics. I mean,
yeah,
you know, baseball is like the perfect game. If you keep up with if you keep up with statistics, who's doing what, who's averaging, you know, who's averaging how many RBIs, who normally pulls to the left against right-handed pitchers, yeah, and so forth. I mean, you can contribute.
Yeah.
You just really have to stay on top of your.
Did you write notes in Braille? Did you take a big ream of Braille notes with you, or just wing it? Or what?
Actually, yeah, I would take notes that I had written in Braille throughout the week, and just have those ready for reference there at the game site.
They needed somebody. You were a warm body, and you were willing to do it, and they let you, and that's great.
I was willing to do it, so it was fun.
You know, nobody ever said, well, how does he do that? He's blind. Well, he does everything else. How did you, you said you were news director at Seymour. How did you read, could you see well enough to read the AP wire?
With magnifiers, but everything I ever read, I had to transpose into Braille. So, I mean, I would spend hours a day just taking the news that I had already typed up or whatever and retranscribing it for myself.
Oh.
That was the way that was the only way I had to do it back in the day.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff you read was local community calendar type announcements and funerals,
oh, yeah,
and things like that. So you could take when the...
I just did that in Braille immediately because I was going to be the only one using it anyway.
So yeah, you would do that in Braille and you would deliver that, but you didn't read much national copy. I guess y'all had Mutual probably.
Everybody. No, we probably had. I know in Seymour we had Mutual. Breckenridge, we probably had. We did. We definitely had Mutual.
Everybody had Mutual
too
back then.
Yeah,
Mutual,
sure,
had thousands of stations. You know,
and
Fulton Lewis Jr.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I think we had a weather wire, but we didn't have a news wire at either one of those radio stations. I eventually worked for a short time at a 100,000 watt FM up in Haskell called KVRP, and they had a news wire.
Yeah.
So you know that it all took a little. It just took a lot of extra time. You know, you had to know that's what was going to be expected. And if there was nobody around to read it, I would stick my little magnifier on it, and then I'd write up a few words on the brailler and go from there.
Okay, from Breckenridge to where? Did you ever get a major market Texas job?
Not in Texas. No. In-laws got a job in Carolina. We were still pretty young in our marriage. Wife wanted to be out here. I like to stay married, so we moved out into this part of the world. And in 86, I got a job in Charlotte at WSOC. At that time, I think we were market number 37 or 39 or something. Today, we're market 25.
Really?
So we're a major radio market now.
So it's a growing area.
It's a tremendously thriving area. Despite the past couple of weeks, we have two banks, two of the nation's largest banks. They're headquartered out here. Bank of America is headquartered in Charlotte, and so is Wachovia, which is just about to be rescued, about to be bought out by Wells Fargo.
I understand they'd had some problems.
Yeah, they lost $9 billion in one quarter, so that would signal some
I did issues. Read something about that, I think.
Yeah, so that's that whole situation is quite fluid right now. It looks like Wells Fargo is going to take it over, and that'll hurt the economy some here. It'll cost some jobs. It could have been a whole lot worse if Citibank had taken it over. Then they probably would have lost many more jobs. But other than the downturn right now in banking, things in Charlotte are booming. There are cranes all over the place. The city it's one of these places that wants to grow and be a vibrant city, but doesn't know how to keep up with its own growth. And transportation is a big problem around here that they're finally starting to address. But it's a very, very comfortable place to live. I've loved it in the 22 years that I've lived out here.
You got the job at this radio station. What did they hire you originally to do?
They hired me originally to come in on Sundays and do a part-time shift, just running the board for a countdown show. And then this is NASCAR country out here. This is the heart of NASCAR country.
Oh, it is.
So we were, oh, yes. We can go into more on that later, but I had to engineer, run the board for the network radio race broadcasts that would come on Sunday afternoons. And so I lived in a little town about 45 miles from here, and every morning, every Saturday morning, I would take the trailways up to Charlotte and do my 10 hours, and then the wife and the in-laws usually would meet me on Sunday afternoon, and we'd drive back home later. And I did that for several months, and then a full-time opportunity came up. It was overnight,
yep.
And I'd already been in the business 10 years at that point. So
yeah, but this was major market.
Yeah, the overnights wouldn't have been that appealing, but you know what? It was a chance to. We were starving to death, and it was a chance to make enough money to eat on, and it was a chance to get into a top 50 market, having never been in a top 50 market before. So
yeah,
I took it. And they haven't been able to run me off yet.
Well, that's how you used to be able to get in radio by agreeing to work Sunday morning.
Oh, sure.
Showing up for 6 months, and then the overnight thing came. I mean, that's your path into radio, and pretty soon, yeah. You know, the overnight, the midday guy quit, and you were doing middays, and the afternoon guy, and you were able to move up like that. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that's true, but... you know, back in the days, the overnights here taught me that there was still a lot I didn't know, even though I'd been in it for 10 years. So I learned a whole lot more about marketing. And, I mean, ratings suddenly were important. They'd never been important before.
Yeah.
So we learned about the whole diary system and how important it is to maintain quarter hours and go after your, and market to your cum and all these kind of radio terms that some people hear and go, huh? But,
Cumes.
We learned a great deal about how it's done in the major markets, and we're able just to move all it up.
Now, these people were playing. What were they playing overnight? What music? What format?
We were country. This radio station has been country since 1971.
Really?
Yes, it's one of what we now call the heritage country stations in America.
Y'all run John Boy and Billy in the morning?
No, but funny you should mention that, because they are based here in Charlotte.
I know.
There are three or four syndicated shows. Charlotte is a dynamic radio market, and there are three or four syndicated radio shows that are actually based out of Charlotte. John Boy and Billy, when I first came here, they were working, they weren't syndicated, and they were on a top 40 station. And then right after I came, they went over to the rock and roll station, to the classic rock station, and now that's where they still operate out of, but they have their own company, their own studios, and of course they're syndicated across America and do extremely well. They still do great in this market. The other, the Ace and TJ show is based here. They're on. You'd normally find them on a top 40 or CHR contemporary hit radio station. They are in this market. There's a Bob and Sherry show that's based out of Charlotte. That's also syndicated around the country. They're more. More edgy talk that leans toward females. So, you know, we've got it's been a pretty dynamic radio market for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I hope John Boy and Billy are not an example of your radio market.
No, they're not. You know what makes them delightful is that they are
nothing.
Is that they, you know, they stand out in being different. Now, you definitely. Can go, and this is the, I guess this is the case in any major city. You can go outside of the city limits, and you find that the world out there is completely different than, you know, the world in town.
Oh yes,
and they're not too far off of some of those rural counties around us. They're from those counties. They're from out there, in the hills and the mountains around here.
I can't take much of John Boy and Billy. It's pretty pretty.
They're nice guys. Johnny's harmless.
I'm sure they are. But this one guy's off mic yelling constantly. Just drives me.
Oh.
I can't.
Yeah, that would be Randy, I guess.
He just drives me crazy. Anyway, so you did overnights for these folks for a while until what came open? Middays?
The 7 to midnight evenings came open, plus a music director position came open, and I had already been, I guess you would call a music coordinator. I had been, adding music in and doing logs, scheduling the music and stuff like that. So when I had the opportunity to become the music director, I'll just segue right into that.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, the assistant program director position, and the assistant program director is the guy who... basically runs the day-to-day operation of the programming department. The program director basically says, okay, here's my concept. Let's make this happen, and you go do it. And that is what I still do today. I'm the assistant program director and the music director, and in a station of this size, that's really too much for a permanent airship. So I at one point was doing afternoons, but now I'm off the air now, except for filling in when someone's on vacation, and sometimes I can handle a weekend event or something. But basically, I supervise the guys on the air and make sure that everything they play is right for them, including.
Now, when you came there, were they carded music? How were they playing music?
Yeah, when I came, we were playing the music on carts, and carts are basically, for anyone who isn't familiar with how radio works, carts are something like 8-track tapes. They look exactly like 8-track tapes, but they're just 2 tracks.
Yeah,
and they
well, actually, 3 counting the cue track makes a third.
Yeah, that's correct. So, back in those days, everything was on cart. Now, not long after I came, we actually started playing CDs direct to air. We were the first station in the market to play CDs right on the air. Wow, what a concept. But we were the last radio station in the Charlotte market to abandon carts. We didn't start using a computer to play all of our commercials and our music on until about the end of 2004.
Whoa!
Yeah, we let go of it really late.
I've got a 3-stack and a cart recorder sitting in a storeroom that I haven't touched in 10 years. that I would ship you if you wanted, you know.
No, we're done with them now, but we weren't done with them a few years ago.
2004, that's pretty... you started playing... Because I guess CDs, we started really getting those in mass in 87. And that's about when you went right after you came.
Yeah, actually, I think it probably was the summer of 86 when we played our first CD on the air.
But they were still playing commercials on card up until the 2000s.
Yes, we were.
All right, in your building, how many radio stations do the people that own your station, how many do they own in your market?
In the Charlotte market, we're owned by CBS, and CBS owns 7 stations in this market.
There are 7 stations in your building right now.
5 of them are in our building, 2 are in another building.
7 stations, 4 FMs and 3 AMs.
5 FMs and 2 AMs.
2 AMs.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got every format covered. You've got soft rock, you've got country, you've got hip-hop, you've got every format covered. And
we've
two
got a lot of formats. Yeah, we've got we're the country guys. We have actually 2 sports AMs because the AM signals complement each other. And when you can't hear one, you can hear the other.
Yeah.
We've got urban and an urban adult contemporary station. We have a CHR, and then we have an 80s and 90s adult station too.
Rocker, but you only deal with the country station.
I only have to deal with country.
Yeah.
If I needed to deal with something else, believe me, I would. But
how do you do, just very quickly, because we're running out of time, how do you do commercials? If they give you the Clyde's Furniture Store to write and record, how do you do that?
Usually I don't have to write them, but if I do, if I have to, I can. But usually... either they give it to me ahead of time and I braille it out on an old Perkins, or they blow it up into really, really big print, and I'll just go in and sit down with our production director and I'll probably read off line by line, because I don't want to hear a whole lot of paper rustling actually on the mic. So if there's not time for me to braille it and I have to read it off print, I'll feed it to him line by line.
And then he'll put it together for you.
Yeah, I can produce, but normally in this situation, I don't really have to produce commercials.
So there's a guy who does production for these radio stations, who runs the actual physical deals with Pro Tools or whatever they record on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't have to do that.
Well, I can do it. There's a lot of things that I do produce, but I don't have to do commercials.
Yeah. Well, I just wondered, but if you do them, you do them in large print, or you still have an old Perkins brailer.
I do.
Yeah. And yeah, you don't deal with computers much at all yourself.
I deal with computers constantly.
Oh, do you?
Every minute of the day, yes.
Really?
Yes. Because the radio station, everything that goes on a radio station now runs through a computer.
Is run by the computer.
Yes. So I'm scheduling music in my office, writing material in my office constantly. I do a lot of writing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's got to be all the music has got to be loaded into to the automation system.
Mm-hmm.
And
So you do that?
I'm dealing with that constantly, yes. Constantly.
Okay, one more very quick question. How much choice do you have of what they play on this country station? None, some, a lot?
In our case, we still have a good deal of choice. We're not mandated by corporate to do anything except be fair. We are able to make our own decisions.
Okay.
That doesn't happen in many companies, but it still happens.
Oh, it doesn't happen in you're one of the very few minorities that has any latitude. Listen, we've killed 55 minutes. What I need you to do, if you don't mind, do you have an email address where somebody could correspond with you that you wouldn't mind giving?
Sure. Yeah, I think
that. Because there's so many blind people. Every other one I interview is interested in radio. And your story is great. I mean, you've been able to make a living doing radio and still are. So give me a quick email address, Rick, if you don't mind.
Okay. The best way to get in touch with me, I guess, is rickmc103@gmail.com. Gmail is Google's mail service.
It is.
Yeah.
We use it all the time. Well, sir, we're going to go and run this weekend, and you may get some emails from blind people who want to get in radio, and sounds like you're doing fine. Hang on just a second. Rick McCracken's been our guest. Hold on just a minute, Rick. Very good. All righty. Thank you so much. Rick McCracken. Get a hold of him if you want to talk to him. Don't forget Houston, Texas, coming up very quick. If you want information on it, email me, philparr@consolidated.net, and I will send you all the information. And if you want to come, we'd love to have you. It's the 24th, 5th, and 6th of October, coming up quick. philparr@consolidated.net. See you next week.